Good morning and welcome to The Wilf Show for the Women's International League for Peace and Freedom. I'm Tana Hartman. And our guest today is Chris Moran. He's the Executive Director of the Interfaith Council. Welcome, Chris.
Thank you, Tana. I'm glad to be here.
Give us just a very brief history of the Interfaith Council, if you would, and a little bit about how it's changed over the years and where you're going with it now.
Well, we're 45 years old this year, and 45 years ago, seven women founded the Interfaith Council from various denominational groups in the community. Mildred Ringwalt, who was one of the founders, was really amazed at how much poverty existed in Carrboro and Chapel Hill, and they felt an obligation to expose it more readily to the community. And over the years, the organization has evolved in so many ways, transformed in so many ways, that once upon a time, we were an organization that organized various projects, and then we turned them over to other groups or formed new nonprofits. A good example of that is Adelaide Walder's Apartments that we built, and actually was the first thing that I did when I came to Interfaith Council years ago, working with residents there. But we would create housing operations and then turn them over to other nonprofits. We organized groups to put seatbelts on school buses. Mm-hmm. At one point, there was a statewide effort by our organization to eliminate the food tax in North Carolina. Today, however, we provide more direct services and I think more advocacy in particular ways to try to change policies that cause poverty and homelessness and hunger to still be in our midst.
Right. There's an awful lot about homelessness and hunger, but those are just the outward symptoms of a very serious and increasingly serious problem. Fairly recently, David Barsamian interviewed Vandana Shiva, and although she was talking about India, what she was saying seems increasingly applicable in this country. She was saying that it's no longer the difference between rich and poor. It has gone way beyond that. It is now the difference between those who appropriate every resource for themselves, for their own greed, and those who are being denied even the option to live. So, tell me how serious the poverty is here in this area and what we're looking at and what the root causes are.
Well, Orange County is ranked fifth in the nation for having the widest gap between the haves and the have-nots.
Now, that's Orange County, not Los Angeles.
No, Orange County, North Carolina.
Really?
Ranked fifth in the nation. And, you know, I look at data all the time because I'm just curious about what the numbers might mean, but in our guts for so many years we've known that. We've realized that in this community where there are so many resources, so many folks that are transplanted from other states, New Jersey, New York, California, and so on, that we still have in this community a significantly large population that is currently carrying the recession on their backs. For many, many years, there was certainly poverty, but as one woman told me recently, she said, "I know what it means to be poor, but this is worse than poverty." So what's happening is...
What does that mean?
Well, what it really means is that people that are in the service economy, working at the university, at Wendy's, McDonald's, and places like that, they're never going to earn any more money. And they're not going to usually have insurance, which is a primary need that most families or most households feel that they have to have for themselves. So as the economy worsens, such as putting gas in your gas tank, going to the local grocery store, going to the doctor or the emergency room, whatever comes first, the expenses for these folks are going to keep rising. So there used to be a time when people occasionally would say, well, what am I going to do this month? Am I going to buy my medicine or am I going to pay my rent? Now it's an everyday thing. It's an everyday experience. And we have people who oftentimes have to move a lot because they can't afford their expenses. And they're trying to downsize or they're trying to find less expense, but it really doesn't get any better.
The IFC is, how do you help people? And what are the primary groups that you're helping?
I really think that the primary service we provide is food. A lot of people think it's shelter, but it's really food. We have 1,470 households from Carrboro and Chapel Hill. Let me rephrase it. 1,470 households that either represent homes here or people coming from other counties working in Carrboro and Chapel Hill that we have made eligible as food pantry members. People now get membership cards for our food pantry, which means that they're entitled to come in once a month to get food from the pantry if that's what they feel they need. And it's actually, I think, going to be sort of the model that we want to use in the future for all of our programs. We want people to feel some entitlement to be members, to self-shop, to have great input into our the design of our programs and how programs operate. And so we have made a lot of changes over the years to make services more accessible. But saying that, if every single member came every month, we would run out of food.
Yeah, and you've seen an increase in the number of people coming, haven't you, over there?
The distribution rate for food in our programs has gone up about 30% on average, which means that we're seeing, and there's probably 70, 80 new households a month that join. That we discover or come to us in various ways. And some folks are rather shy about coming back every month because they've said to us, well, you know, maybe there are others that need it more than we do. I've actually heard that said. And frankly, food or the disappearance of food in our communities is a serious problem.
What other services do you all offer?
Beyond food, we provide residential services for men, women, and children in two what are known as shelter facilities, Home Start and Community House. And I think last year we served about 780 different individuals in that regard who needed shelter, and about 70 to 80% of those were experiencing homelessness for the first time. We pride ourselves in trying to do more community education about social issues, why these problems exist, how communities can join together to talk more fervently about how elected officials and community leaders can actually make changes to eliminate or reduce some of these issues. Advocacy has always been known as one of the trademarks of our organization. We're not afraid to speak out about particular issues or point out certain injustices that can exist in our communities based upon what we see every day.
What are some of the root causes?
It's a complicated question. My view is that there are two main causes for homelessness. Poverty, which has widened and deepened in this country for the last 20 to 30 years, and the reduction of housing units in many communities, such as the proposed controversy around Glen Lennox. If units disappear and they're not replaced, it becomes harder and harder for individuals to find accommodations for themselves. We always talk about, we do have public housing, we do have some entitlement programs that still exist, but we have many, many people doubled and tripled up in existing units in the community, only because that's a means for survival. You can reduce the economic burden by living with another family or a couple of families, or sometimes people that meet within shelter programs will decide to live together. It could be a disastrous decision, or it could be a good decision, but invariably one of those individuals becomes homeless again. Hate to be so depressing.
Yeah. Well, it is a serious and depressing issue. The poverty. I mean, do you have ideas about how we could, what policies are needed to help us alleviate?
Well, one of the interesting things when I was involved in the 10-year planning process to end homelessness in this community, I never heard the word poverty mentioned. I really never heard a discussion about that. And I think there's a lot of misunderstanding about what the root causes are. We don't understand that just about every social issue that we could describe is interconnected to another issue. So if you can't talk about domestic violence without talking about homelessness or healthcare, you can't talk about literacy or the lack of it without talking about other issues. And I think that decision makers and community members need to understand and need to start vocalizing the fact that this is a holistic issue that we need to own and we need to dig a little bit deeper about in order to find solutions. And a lot of the solutions usually don't represent dollars in a budget to address the situation.
What do you mean?
Well, I remember a town council member one time saying as I was leaving the chambers, in fact, I think Lucy, who was sitting across from me, was there at that meeting.
That's Lucy Lewis.
Yes, an old friend. She said, before you all leave the room, she said, I want you to remember something. And this was over the naming of Martin Luther King Boulevard. And she said that, remember to look at our budget next year and see what we really represent. And if you see other recommendations in the budget which are attached to dollars that might actually address some of the racism that has evolved over this discussion, you might understand that we really are interested in that subject. But if it's not there, are we?
Yeah, that's a good point. What have you seen? I mean, what kind of a response and what kind of... what kind of a response have you all gotten from, you know, local governments?
Well, there is an incredibly large human service budget that the county disperses every year. I think it's about $1 million plus to local nonprofits, but it just isn't enough money. And I know that there are a lot of nonprofits right now sort of crying out and saying, look, you know, we put in applications, there were dollars that were allocated and then they went away because there's going to be budget difficulties. But that's always the case, frankly. Any governmental body trying to be responsible can say, well, we don't have enough money because there are budget constraints. I think the question lies in what dollars are being allocated, how are they being spent, and how can additional human service funds be made available to take care of local needs. And governments are not necessarily the right vehicles for solving human service problems, but they can partner with nonprofits in better ways.
Such as?
Well, when we move our facility to university property someday, we hope that local governments will provide us the operational support that we need to do that job well. And because there's no federal money left anymore, and there's not going to be after the next election, as long as we have a war and as long as candidates say they're not going to raise taxes or reallocate taxes among different income groups. And frankly, would the same amount of money that's been spent in Iraq be put into human services or housing or healthcare in this country?
But if it would, that would help a lot, right?
It would help tremendously.
there are a couple of problems here besides homelessness or housing. There's also the issue of food accessibility, food sovereignty, and how. First, where does your funding come from? where does the food come from? Do you all go out, I mean, just take money, go out and buy it? Or are people donating food? Have the donations grown? Are there more coming in?
Donations have really grown. We've seen over the summer more than we've ever. Usually our pantry, our food pantry is bare. The shelves are bare in summertime because it's not Thanksgiving. It's not a traditional religious holiday when people seem to give more.
Yeah.
But this summer has been very different. And I think that the we've developed a liaison structure within congregations, and liaisons have really worked very, very hard to raise more food for us in different ways, either in the last May postal drive where folks put things out, or what is referred to as Project 5000 collections within congregations, which have increased. And I think the community understands in better ways that since the fuel and food crisis that arose a number of months ago, that we all understand that food is more expensive. So one of the things that we're trying to do as an organization is to build or retrofit our current Carbrill building into a place where all food programs could coexist. And we could provide more self-sufficient models such as community gardens, canning programs, and the such to help folks learn new resources or develop new resources since food prices have escalated.
What's your demographic? Where do the people who come to you come from?
Most of the food programs are really Orange County residents or habitants that come to our facilities. When we talk about homelessness, I usually like to look at it as a triangle population, one that is more transient only because people can't find housing, they can't find living wage jobs, they can't find health benefits. I remember a man one time saying to me that he was going to move to Charlotte because he couldn't afford to live here. And part of the reason why he couldn't afford to live here is because he had been an ex-offender, and his employer was only paying him minimum wage as a cook, where other people within the same business were making much more. And he said he couldn't pay his child supports, and he really wanted to do that, so he was going to go to Charlotte to see if his situation would improve. And that's just one little example of what we see all of the time.
What could local and state governments do? I mean, what policy changes would you like to see that would make a difference?
Well, certainly improving the human service safety net that once existed for low-income folks on a national level. And seeing more leadership where elected officials would be talking about these issues all the time and saying we have a responsibility to deal with it, so we're going to allocate dollars. If you look at the 10-year plan to end homelessness, there's not one additional dollar that was set aside in Bush's budget for that effort. But mayors were signing on to it all across the country. And I've always asked, well, where is the money going to come from? How are the recommendations that have been made going to be handled without having adequate funding? On a state level, there are only one or two people that work in the state of North Carolina that have anything to do with homelessness. In other words, have responsibilities to look at that problem in general. Why is that? Why aren't there more resources set aside to look at homelessness differently in North Carolina?
Well, I'd like you to tell us more about how they might look at it. When you say look at it differently, what you mean. But let me just take a moment here to tell you all that you are listening to WCOM, and we are a listener-supported, wholly listener-supported community radio station. We depend on you, our listeners, for support in keeping this radio station, which is your community voice, on the air. So please support us. You can send a check to WCOM, 201 North Greensboro Street, Carrboro, 27510. Or you can go to our website, www.communityradio.coop, and click on the Donate Now button. And we have a secure server, and any donations and all your information are protected. So keep listening to WCOM. And now we're back to Chris Moran. Chris, to continue, you were talking about these the policy changes, but tell a little bit more about what you meant with your last.
Well, I think a lot of the solutions or ways to address problems need to be more pragmatic. For instance, we serve 700 plus individuals a year. We want to serve them well, and we want to move these folks back into the community. And it would be actually a very cost-effective thing for governments, instead of building new units, which are going to serve very few people, to set aside less money that would help subsidize people to move into existing housing in the community, or provide more case management staff to work with folks so that they don't become marginalized once they move out of shelter facilities.
No, wait a minute, I don't understand that. Provide less money? All right,
so. Well, I think if we or someone had about $500,000 instead of the $3 to $6 million price mm-hmm. tag that was recommended to build 40 Housing First units,
okay.
If $500,000 was made available, we could move a hell of a lot of people out of our facilities back into the community, subsidizing some of those situations. Let's say someone is on Social Security disability, which is about $600 a month. We could help subsidize some of those costs, so that individual could have a roof over his or her head, and to be a functional member of the community. If case managers were hired to work with certain caseloads to help folks stay in that housing, to access other services, and to volunteer, to work, to do various things that that people really want to do, it would be, I think it would be a less cost, it would be a cost-effective, less expensive way to address the problem.
You were saying a little bit ago that these issues are all interconnected, and certainly there's the issue of not just housing and food access, but education, healthcare, reintegration into the into society for, among others, the offenders.
Mm-hmm.
And how do we get people to look at that, to look at how they're connected?
I think, as I told Neil Offen one day, the editor over at the Herald, I think that more people would vote and more people would get involved if the news media would dig a little bit deeper into why these problems exist and not let it go away. And I think that we all sort of privately talk to one another about what bothers us, but there's not a lot of public discussion about why are folks poor? For instance, the whole subject about panhandling is so misconstrued. We never get into a discussion about street people and why that culture and why that reality exists and who these individuals are. But we invariably get into a discussion about why panhandlers bother us.
Mm-hmm.
And why is it that our mental health institutions and larger institutions fail these folks again and again and again and again? And should they not take more responsibility? And shouldn't local communities really address that with institutions on a regular basis until the change takes place?
Yeah. Well, we've seen awfully serious and substantive cuts to help mental health care, too, although we now have a parity bill, but how good and how effective that's going to be still remains to be seen. Where would you get, if you were directing people to start talking about this, how would we get a community dialogue started?
Well, I think that that's a good question. I'm not exactly sure how to answer it, but I think one of the best places to encourage more discussion is in congregations.
Okay.
For instance, I said to the chamber group recently, there was all this discussion about water shortages and carbon reduction issues and sustainable food resources. I said, all of these topics need to be packaged in a way, and funding should be given. If I had a lot of money and I ran a foundation, I would give money to a nonprofit to figure out a way to go into congregations and educate congregants about all of these issues together and how we as a community could change in order to improve the environment, improve, make this a quality place for all folks to live. And until we realize what the impact of not doing anything is really going to be, it's going to be I think particularly difficult to make these changes.
Yeah, it's a tall order. There's no
Very
question
tall
about
order.
It. But just possibly people who are out there listening who belong to a congregation, you might initiate and start this dialogue. And before we have to wrap up, I want to... I'd like you to tell people how they can get involved, how they can contact you, and what it is you need from them.
Well, we always gladly accept money for those who would like to make contributions. And they can. We have a website, which is www.ifcweb.org. Our phone number is 929-6380. But food, we need lots of food. We need volunteers to handle the phones, to be client interviewers, to do evening work at our residential facilities, to work in the food pantry. And without volunteers, we just wouldn't be the same organization. And that's what's incredible about it, in my opinion, that so many people are involved. But saying that, we need many more shareholders to step forward and be involved or ask how they can participate, and we will certainly figure it out for them.
That's great. I want to, before we have to close now, I want to tell you about to tune into our next show, which is going to be an interview with a leader in the local 369, which has been on strike for the past month in Moncure, just southeast of Pittsburgh. And the workers are striking because the plywood company is trying to impose a mandatory 60-hour work week and a 400% increase in family health insurance. That's unconscionable. But don't forget to tune in to the Wilf Show. And Chris, I want to thank you for being here, and I hope people will give you a call and get involved, volunteer, find out what is needed and how you can help. And this has been the Women's International League for Peace and Freedom radio show. We're here every week at Fridays at 7:30 a.m. and I hope you'll tune in again next week. You are listening now to WCOMLP Chapel Hill and Carrboro, your local listener-supported radio station. Thank you, and talk to you next week.